But first, on Radio 4, to another infinite being. God moves, it said, in mysterious ways. The same might be said about the way he speaks. What does God sound like? With the help of the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Chief Rabbi, a prominent Muslim commentator and a cinema expert, the Reverend Richard Coles investigates how God's speech is depicted in sacred texts and in popular culture. In the Voice of God.
I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob.
Vox Dei, Vox Hestoniensis. Yes, Charlton Heston giving possibly the least ironic performance of his career as God in the Ten Commandments. It's God by central casting, robed, bearded, and given to speaking in the cadences of 17th century English. Heston enjoyed the scene so much he expressed his might and majesty and took unto himself the part of God's interlocutor, Moses, too.
Lord, why do you not hear the cries of their children in the bondage of Egypt? I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows.
What do you make of the sort of beardy gods and their voices that you find in, well, in Hollywood epics, for example?
I couldn't possibly comment.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams.
Well, there is this sense that God must sound like God, and we all know that God sounds like Brian Blessed.
I'm making a jam sandwich!
That familiar booming voice, which simply speaks of masculinity, authority, and dominance.
Therefore I will send thee, Moses, unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring my people out of Egypt.
I do find that quite difficult. It's not quite the waspish, argumentative God you meet in the Old Testament, asking awkward questions and occasionally making fun of people. It's certainly not the still, small voice that Elijah encounters. It's not the northern-accented peasant, rather irreverent voice of Jesus telling his stories.
I will teach thee what thou wilt say.
It's precisely what we would expect, and therefore something we ought to be a bit wary of.
In general, in Genesis, he speaks in a very intimate person-to-person way.
Lord Sacks is the chief rabbi and, like Rowan Williams, hears God speaking with a range of voices, some of them of the grandest kind.
Uniquely in Exodus chapters 19 and 20, you have this enormous public revelation at Mount Sinai, where I think for the only time in history, the only place in any religious literature, God speaks to an entire nation. And there it happens with thunder, lightning, the sound of the ram's horn. The people tremble. They say to Moses, please, you hear what he has to say and communicate it to us, because if we hear any more, we will die. And then, of course, in the prophetic books, he speaks to individuals in very distinctive ways. So the way Isaiah encounters God is not the way Ezekiel encounters God, for instance.
So does God tune his voice, if I could put it that way, to the audience, to the hearer?
The rabbis held that God always speaks in a way that people can understand. So the nature of the revelation is always very much specific to the context, the occasion, and the person.
Nevertheless, that commanding mode has tended to characterise the God of popular culture, especially in cinema, according to Dr. Matthew Sweet, even when addressing individuals rather than entire nations.
There are types that have developed over time. There's the disembodied voice,
Noah,
that booms down from the heavens, often with the voice of John Huston.
Hearken now to my voice and take heed, for now shall I tell thee the matter of my grief and of what thou shalt do. The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them.
John Huston made a film modestly called The Bible, even though it only covered the first half of the book of Genesis.
And behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, and everything that is in the earth shall die.
He played Noah in that film. He directed it and he played God too, which gives you some insight into the vastness of his ego, but also says something, I think, about the place of a God-like character in the production of all films. All films have God on hand. He's often standing there with a megaphone and sometimes in jodhpurs and big leather boots. But Houston really embodies that idea of the God-like director. So it seems weirdly appropriate that he should cast himself in this part.
Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Room shalt thou make in the ark, and shalt pitch it within and without with pitch. And this is the fashion thou shalt make it of.
From the beginning of the talkies, this is the way in which God's voice is imagined. In the silence, of course, you can do the same thing that the Bible does. You just put the words up on the screen, and the voice resonates in the minds of the audience. But pretty soon, the biblical epic was a central genre in the silent days, and it remained popular when the talkies came in. And so directors had to find ways of doing this.
With thee will I establish my covenant, and thou shalt come into the ark, thou and thy sons, and thy wife, and thy sons' wives with me. For thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation.
Archbishop, there's a wealth of witness concerning the voice of God in the Judeo-Christian tradition. Mm-hmm. Where does it begin?
The very first thing is the voice of God in the beginning of creation. The first thing that happens is God says, "Let there be." So the speech of God just lets things happen. And the second big moment in Genesis is the first question in the Bible, which is God saying to Adam, "Where are you?" And those are two quite good places for thinking about the voice of God. It's the communication that lets something happen. It's also the question, where are you? Who are you? What are you doing?
Can it be said to be a conversation?
It very often is in the Bible, of course, and in one of the most effective and dramatic moments in the book of Genesis, it's not just a conversation, it's an argument between Abraham and God, where God says he's about to destroy the city of Sodom, and Abraham says, "You're absolutely sure about that?" And this goes on for the best part of a chapter, with Abraham occasionally stepping back and saying, "What am I doing? I'm arguing with God. Oh, well, I've started, so I'll finish." And God patiently negotiating with Abraham through that chapter. So, yes, a conversation, sometimes an argument too.
"The gloves are off, God. God has taken my bird and my bush. God is a mean kid with a magnifying glass. Smite me, O mighty smiter." Now, I'm not much for blaspheming, but that last one made me laugh.
Are you spying on me?
We do love to argue with God, and have done, as the Archbishop points out, from very early on in our relationship. Contemporary culture, interestingly, picks this up. Jim Carrey, in the film Bruce Almighty, takes on Morgan Freeman.
"Who are you?"
"I'm the one. Huh? Creator of the heavens and the earth. Alpha and Omega."
By this point, I think the question might be, is God an authoritative enough part for Morgan Freeman to play? So identified is he with wisdom, with authority.
"Oh, I see where this is going.
Bruce, I'm God."
"Bingo! Yahtzee! Is that your final answer? Our survey says God! Bing, 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 bing! Well, it was nice to meet you, God. Thank you for the Grand Canyon, and good luck with the apocalypse."
Is there a danger that the currency can be debased? I'm thinking of the use of that kind of voice for the sale of products, for example. I mean, for men who don't have to try too hard.
Yes.
Or probably the best lager in the world. Yeah. Does that...
A man called Bill Wallace. Bill Wallace, yes, the voice of the dear man for it.
I'm just thinking, did something happen? Did the kind of great chasm of irony open up sometime after those first talky biblical epics? And in that chasm of irony, has it now become impossible to do God in that sort of gravelly authoritative way?
It hasn't become impossible at all. In fact, in The Prince of Egypt, recent CGI animation film that tells the Moses story made by DreamWorks, God is represented as a burning bush with the voice of Val Kilmer.
"So I have come down to deliver them out of slavery and bring them to a good land."
And very much in the slightly softer, gentler, more conciliatory, slightly more the voice of a Californian therapist.
"A land flowing with milk and honey.
But when he's riled, he goes straight back into Houston, Heston mode, and Moses cowers before him.
You've chosen the wrong messenger. How can I even speak to these people? Who made man's power? Who made the deaf, the mute, the seeing, or the blind? Did not I? Now go!
Throwing his box of tissues across the consulting room. But there's much greater variety to be found in the sacred texts, those slightly caricatured versions lampoon.
Sometimes the way God addresses you is a message in itself.
For example, Lord Sacks believes the medium is at one with the message.
Famously, that of course comes with Elijah, because on Mount Carmel, Elijah the zealot had challenged 450 prophets of Baal to a great test, which involved God sending down fire from heaven. Some days later, God sends him the whirlwind that shatters rocks and shakes the mountains, but God wasn't in the whirlwind. Then he sends a fire, but God wasn't in the fire. And then he sends an earthquake, but God wasn't in the earthquake. And then God speaks in Hebrew, Kol Dmama Daka, sometimes translated as a still small voice. It literally means the voice of a very slender silence. And I define that as in a voice you can only hear if you're listening. And I think that's the way God speaks to us now. You can only hear if you're listening.
What might you do to put yourself in the way of God if you wished to hear God speak?
You'd find a place that was pretty silent, following Elijah. Get into the desert, the well-known method, or alternatively into a very well-managed silent community.
But the key thing is to find yourself in a place that is hushed to the world's bustle?
Hushed to the world's bustle, and I think probably hushed to mediating voices as well.
Sarah Maitland, author of a wonderful book on silence, is a hermit, living about as remotely as she possibly can in Britain, with only a rather poor quality phone line connecting her to us.
Moses has to be in the desert looking after sheep before he hears the voice of God. Abraham has to be in the desert before he hears the voice of God. The big prophets are very keen on going to the desert to hear the voice of God. Muhammad went to the desert to hear the voice of God. There seems to be a relationship between external silence and hearing the voice of God.
Do you think that you hear, have heard, might hear the voice of God in the elected silence that's yours?
Yes, but probably not as a direct auditory experience. I definitely would say I experience the presence of God. But on the whole, God doesn't communicate with me in well-rounded sentences with the semicolons in the right place.
Right.
That's not my personal experience.
Cinemas with popcorn-shaking surround sound might seem among the last places you'll find silence. It ain't necessarily so.
In more serious attempts to represent spiritual life, dialogue with God, then actually silence is the most fantastically powerful cinematic tool. There's a French film called Of Gods and Men about a group of Trappist monks who are in Algeria in the 90s and under threat from Islamic fundamentalists who want them out of the place and are threatening them, and have to decide whether or not they're going to stay with the community in which they've lived happily for decades or whether they have to go. And it's a film that's distinguished by the absence of effects like that, and you simply get lots of time with these men just sort of thinking and contemplating. And there's the odd cliche of a shaft of light through a window, but it's never really insisted upon. And so you get a much more sophisticated portrayal of what might actually be going on between these men and their God.
Can we grow deaf to that or dull to that in a culture which is perhaps full of noise and clamour and full of people's urgent desire to impress themselves upon one another?
I think we can, and one of the things that I sometimes say to people at the beginning of a silent retreat is this is an opportunity for not trying to get on top of the situation. If you're going to be silent, there's really no way you're going to manage this and process it in the way you normally do. You may feel at a disadvantage, you may feel you want to make an impression on the people around you. Well, you can't. Sorry, just get used to it. Shut up.
The key word in Judaism, and again, it's not translatable into English, is Shema, which means any of the following: to listen, to hear, to understand, to internalize, and to respond in action. Now, there's no English word that means all those five things. The King James Bible, 400 years ago, was able to use the word hearken. Now, we don't do a lot of hearkening nowadays, so we don't actually have that one word. But it is the key word of Jewish faith. The most famous line in Jewish faith from Deuteronomy is, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one."
I think the silence is cumulative. The more of it you have at a stretch, the better its quality is. That's why I'm just so impressed by these people who can be hermits in the middle of a city, or, you know, Catherine of Siena saying she carried her hermitage in her heart while she rushed about Europe being highly and contentiously political.
Yes. I used to find, when I was attached to a monastery for a couple of years and used to find moments of silence, there was one in the evening where I would be in silence, and then all of a sudden in the summer, an ice cream van would go past and play an irritating little tune. But I began to think that maybe that was part of the experience too. Maybe there was something of call in that I was missing. I don't know.
Well, and you left the convent and became a parish priest, so obviously there was some element of call in it.
Yes.
More ice cream vans for you, my boy.
I never could resist a 99.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, Maliki Yawm al-Din. Iyaka na'abudu wa iyaka nasta'in. Ihdina as-sirat wal-mustaqim as-sirat al-ladhina anamta alayhim. Ghayri al-maghdubi alayhim wal-dallin. Amin.
Muslim commentator Muhammad Ansar intoning the opening verses of the Quran.
The words of the Quran, which are essentially unchanged for the last 1400 years, not a comma, not a word, not a letter, are revelations given to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, from God via the Archangel Gabriel. We would consider this, without any question, to be the word of God.
If not the speech of God, the Quran preserves the word of God, and we shall know it by its beauty. So beautiful, in fact, a couple of lines stayed the murderous hand of Umar ibn al-Khattab, who intended to kill the Prophet, but ended up being converted by them to Islam.
This was considered to be an untouchable, preeminent work of poetry, and even today, if you examine the Quran, it is miraculous in its use of poetry, in its construction and in its form, and it is absolutely, for people who understand Arabic, a thing which is absolutely unmatched. So learning the Quran and transmitting that message to others is hugely significant and hugely important in Islam. We know that in most towns and villages and cities where Muslims are, they have somebody who is considered to be Hafiz. And a Hafiz is somebody who has memorized every line, every word and every page of the Quran, which is actually quite incredible. It's like saying that somebody has memorized the entire New Testament, word by word, verse by verse. Somebody said the figure was somewhere in the region of 50,000 Hafiz, or Hifz al-Quran, across the world. Even if every physical copy of the Quran was taken away tomorrow, we'd be able to reproduce copies instantly.
We may not quite want to say that God speaks Arabic, but he makes himself known in Arabic across the Islamic world, from northern Russia to New Zealand. Rowan Williams stands in a different tradition.
It's a bigger problem in a sense for Christians than for some others, because we believe in translation. We don't have a sacred language, and so we always have to wrestle with this fact that God doesn't just speak Hebrew or Greek or Arabic or whatever it might be. And what people often say about a first encounter with a vernacular translation of the Bible is, it is hearing God in my own language. I do find when I read the Bible in Welsh, it feels a bit different. It reminds me of my grandmother. It reminds me of a particular climate of Welsh Valley life in the 50s and carrying over from a much earlier generation. The language is homely in a way that it isn't in English.
That familiar, intimate God, whom we might recognise from our own lives, is also found in cinema.
There's a film of the early 30s called The Green Pastures, where God is played by Rex Ingram, who's a black actor, African-American actor.
Let the fish fry proceed.
And there is this disclaimer put on the front of the film as a kind of apology to audience members who may be bothered by this, saying that everybody has their own idea of what God looks like, but this is a film that's going to put the Negro conception of God onto the screen. He plays a character called Dalord.
Get away from Dalord. Good morning, Lord.
Morning, Archangel. You're looking mighty spry.
Can't complain, Lord.
That's good.
Are there national or kind of regional characteristics to God? I mean, I'm wondering that the God of Hollywood, I wonder how much is influenced by Jewish emigres coming to Hollywood. And is a Northern European God the God of Scandinavian cinema, British cinema, perhaps?
What's true is that there's a sort of English influence upon Hollywood's conception of God because of the people who are brought in to play him. Ralph Richardson, for instance. Somehow an actor knight suits the part. You know, that's why Laurence Olivier plays Zeus in Clash of the Titans.
It's interesting you said that. I spoke to someone who nearly died a little while ago, a chap in a nursing home. He wasn't a religious person, but he said that God had come to see him to tell him that it was all okay. And I said, how did you know it was God? And he said he had an old Etonian tie. And I wonder if the Ralph Richardsonian God was the one that was informing his understanding of what had happened to him.
Well, Ralph Richardson's portrayal of him is of a rather bored high civil servant, a man from the ministry, really. Yeah. Certainly a figure of the British establishment, somebody who's doing these duties but doesn't really take any relish in them. You know, he's not one of these theatrical gods. He doesn't enjoy appearing in a cloud or a flash of lightning. In fact, it seems rather to exhaust him.
Oh, hi. I hate having to appear like that. Really is the most tiresomely noisy manifestation. So, well, they're expected of one, I suppose.
Get down, get down. Oh, great one. Oh, supreme being. Oh, creator of all the universe, without whom we'll be naught but scarab beetles on the...
dreadful mess.
Do you think God, then, has become... God is always, of course, beyond reach, I say, speaking from a sort of faith zone. But do you think God is especially beyond reach now? Because the only way we can approach it is through something which is so inflected with irony or knowingness that a sort of innocent encounter is no longer possible.
Well, in a way, I don't know whether this has done God too much harm, because although we're now pretty sceptical about God as Oz, the booming voice coming down from the sky, when we encounter that in the cinema, you know, we expect it to turn into a Monty Python joke.
Oh, don't grovel. One thing I can't stand, it's people grovelling.
Sorry.
And don't apologise. Every time I try to talk to someone, it's sorry this and forgive me that and I'm not worthy. What are you doing now?
I'm avoiding my eyes, oh Lord.
Well, don't.
If you look at those representations of God that represent him in a much more human way, those rather more modest gods actually do engage in some way with the impossibility of representing God. I mean, what sort of God do you really want?
Yeah.
George Burns in the comedy Oh God.
Driving a taxi,
yeah. You know, this little kind of monkey-faced man in a check shirt who writes a letter to John Denver, who's working in a supermarket, granting him an interview. And he doesn't even spell the word interview right. So this is a God who is not only not omnipresent...
I'm bigger than mere spelling.
He's not omnipresent, he's not omniscient, he's not omni-anything, really. Yeah. Yeah. And yet when he gets up in court, as the story commands him to do, he has an authority that works.
May I ask who you are, sir?
You better swear me in. You'll never believe it.
You swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
So help me, me.
So help you?
If it pleases the court, and even if it doesn't please the court, I'm God, Your Honor.
So help me, me. That's a gag that gets returned to. But for all its silliness, it's quite a grown-up version of the character, if yeah. I can put it like that. This is a God who says, well, I can't fix everything for you. You know, I've done my bit. The rest is up to you. You know, this is not an idea that you won't find in the pulpit, is it?
So God, for all the ineffability, can be a surprisingly familiar figure. But can God be a female figure?
The last 26 chapters of Isaiah certainly give God a female voice as well. God says, like one whom his mother comforts, so shall I comfort you. He says, can a mother forget a child she has borne? Even if that were possible, I will not forget you. And we miss one thing in translation, which is that the Hebrew word for compassion, and God is full of compassion, I mean, that's absolutely said again and again in the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew word comes from the word meaning womb. So God is not just a father, but also a mother in a sense.
Sometimes she's Alanis Morissette in Kevin Smith's film Dogma.
Lovely voice.
Yeah, lovely voice. And also a woman with a history of engaging with theological ideas in her music. She appears first as a woman in a rather sylph-like dress, holding flowers, as if she might have walked out of Woodstock. But she's also capable of quite Old Testament acts of vengeance.
Anyone who isn't dead or from another plane of existence would do well to cover their ears right about now.
She blows off Ben Affleck's head at one point with a mighty shout. But we never really hear her speak. And in fact, once she's sort of sorted the plot out, she then rips off this gown that she has, revealing a sort of prom outfit, a little frou-frou skirt and a silvery jacket. And she goes skipping off kookily down the road. She's not a figure of traditional authority.
All divers, beasts on land I send to breed, and be with bale forthwrought, and with the beasts a bit to blend.
Neither was Brian Glover's portrayal of God a figure of traditional authority, riding around on a forklift truck for the National Theatre's Mysteries, a 20th century reworking of a play from medieval Wakefield.
Serpents to be seen unsought, and worms upon their wombs will wend, and woe in earth and worth to naught.
Brian Glover was not the only performer with a regional accent to portray this character on the British stage.
Unusually for a primate, you have played God.
I won't examine that statement in its depth, but yes, I hear what you're saying. Yes, when I was a student, I got to play God in a medieval mystery play, I think because I had the sort of voice people imagine that God has. it was interesting, of course, because in the medieval mystery plays, God does largely speak in those booming tones.
And so it shall be kenned how all is made that ought, beginning, midst, and end, I, with my word, have wrought.
And you had to make some dramatic decisions about how to do that and how to bring into it any element of emotional variety. So challenging in its way.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. The Voice of God was presented by the Reverend Richard Coles and produced by Julian May.